At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Dinah Jeffries, who was born in Malaysia and moved to England at the age of 9. She's the best-selling author of The Tea Planter's Wife. Her idyllic childhood always held a special place in her imagination, and when she began writing novels in her 60s, she was able to return there, first in her fiction and then on annual research trips for each new novel. Her latest, The Sapphire Widow, is a sweeping, breathtaking story of love and betrayal. Also on the show is Oggy Bochev, who escaped from behind the Iron Curtain in 1986. Soon after, he joined the BBC in London, where he spent the next 25 years covering international conflicts. He became John Simpson's producer and accompanied him on dangerous undercover assignments around the world. His memoir, Simpson and I, chronicles that time. But he was with us on the book show to talk about The Unbeliever, a historical novel that gives a gripping account of real Cold War espionage from a new perspective. We also have C.D. Rose, who's the author of the satirical book The Biographical Dictionary of Literary Failure and is an award-winning short story writer. His novel, Who's Who When Everyone Is Someone Else, is another hilarious spoof of modernist literature, all the while telling a suspenseful story about someone desperate to prove the redeeming power of reading. And finally on tonight's book show is Dee McDonald, who flew as a stewardess on long-haul routes for 8 years. She was also the receptionist at Thames Television Studios. Her latest novel, The Runaway Wife, is a laugh-out-loud, feel-good novel about second chances. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Dinah Jeffries. She was born in Malaysia and moved to England at the age of 9. Her idyllic childhood always held a special place in her imagination, and when she began writing novels in her 60s, she was able to return there, first in her fiction and then on annual research trips for each new novel. She's with us back on the book show to talk about her latest novel, The Sapphire Widow. It's a sweeping, breathtaking story of love and betrayal. Welcome to the book show, Dinah.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So it was a couple of years ago, I think, when we last spoke, wasn't it?
Well, Tea Planter's Wife. Tea Planter's Wife? Well, that was actually 3 years ago.
Oh, wow. Gosh.
I know, hasn't it flown?
Yes, absolutely. So is this a similar setting, shall we say?
Well, interestingly, this is set back in Ceylon, which is where The Tea Planter's Wife was set, although in a different place. And there's really good news about it, because first of all, it was chosen for the Rich and Judy Book Club summer pick. And I heard the other day that after only 3 days' sales by Saturday night, it's now in the top 10.
Fantastic.
So, in Sunday Times. So on Sunday, that will be in their book list. So it's really good news, and I've got my fingers crossed that things continue as well. Yeah, this time it's set in a beautiful walled town of Gaul, which is surrounded by the Indian Ocean, and also on a cinnamon plantation just a little further inland, and also during the 1930s. So there are connections with The Tea Planter's Wife, as well as a few of the characters from Tea Planter's Wife do appear, but only as minor characters. But we do find out what has happened to them in the ensuing few years.
And do you have to do quite a lot of research for these books?
Yes, an awful lot, really. Less so with this one, because I'd already I'd already read all about Ceylon and the history of Ceylon and the politics of Ceylon and the social sort of life of the British who lived over there at that time. The sad thing about this was that I was due to go there to not only research Gaul and the cinnamon plantation, but also to speak at the Gaul Literature Festival, which is a lovely, lovely festival. Only I was taken ill and in hospital, and so I wasn't able to go, and I wasn't able to do the research either, because for some time after I wasn't allowed to fly. So this was an interesting experience for me. I had to do a lot more research online and talking to people who'd lived there and reading books set at different periods of time or memoirs to get the really strong feel of the place that I like to have in my books, you know. I wanted the pages to sort of waft the scent, the flavour, the sound from the scent of cinnamon and citronella to the salty tang of the Indian Ocean. So I needed to have a feeling of that really strongly before I could write the book.
And is it difficult to do that? Is it difficult to write in such a way where people can, you know, feel those feelings and feel like they're actually there and the smells, as you say, jumping off the page?
I don't find it difficult. I mean, it's what I do. I like to enable my readers to actually feel as if they're there. So not only the sort of sensory world, but also the emotional world of the character. So I want them to go through the complex emotions that my character goes through as if they were sitting on her left shoulder. So it's just, that's the way I write. So it's not difficult because it comes naturally.
Yes, fantastic. So tell us about one of your main characters then, Louisa.
Okay, so Louisa is a young wife, apparently happily married to a sort of charming, charismatic husband, Elliot. She is convinced that they have a great marriage, but she still struggles with their inability to have children and Elliot's occasional reckless behaviour. And then after the shock of his sudden death, several mysteries are slowly revealed, exposing a side of her husband she had never known or truly acknowledged. So it becomes a tale of heartbreak, betrayal, but ultimate hope. And I try to ease my reader into this story, which is about marital issues, which at first appear typical, but are soon revealed to be a sort of dark mesh of secrets. And we then follow Louise's attempts to find some sort of resolution and find the courage to work her way through it. So that's basically her story.
And presumably, reading the book, we sympathise with Louisa, do we?
Oh, I should hope so, yes. I mean, she didn't know that her marriage was built on lies. And for her, it's about learning to love again after finding out the truth that underlay her marriage. And funnily enough, I got an email from a woman yesterday who said, "You've written my story."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I don't think it's so rare what happens in this book, but you know, there are lots of twists and turns that are shocking and unexpected, and I try to slowly build up the revelations by almost keeping my reader's attention drawn to something else, and then that makes what happens seem so much more dramatic. And there are sensitive issues within the novel. It isn't just betrayal, love and betrayal. There's infertility, infidelity, bereavement, grief. And ultimately, which I try to do with every book, I want to show the strength and resilience of the human spirit, because that's what the book is really about.
It must be very difficult if you find out things, you know, not very nice things about a loved one after they've died, because you can't confront them about it. You don't get the closure with it.
Absolutely. I mean, what on earth do you do with it? Because, you know, especially if it's someone you really did love and really did trust, then the betrayal as on top of the grief, it must be really, really hard. And as you say, I mean, how are you supposed to feel? You can't be angry, you can't confront them, you can't, you know, you're kind of stuck with it.
Yeah.
This complex sort of mix of emotions that must be very, very hard to work through. And that's what I give her to do, and that's what she has to do. And the story is about how she does it. And I think, you know, the other thing is, what do you do with the love? You know, one minute you're grieving and you're feeling the love for the person. The next minute you find out you've been betrayed, or gradually. Where does the love go? Do you just turn it off, or what? You know, it must be hard.
Definitely.
Really hard.
Very confusing.
Yeah, and I know that my readers do. I've heard from people that they like the sort of complex emotions and heartbreaking kind of situations that my characters find themselves in and have to work their way through. So I've done that with this book.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the character of Leo?
Ah, right. Leo is the owner of a cinnamon plantation where Elliot spent much of his time, apparently helping Leo get the plantation back on its feet. I say apparently. Leo is a sort of silent, steely, sensitive man, very attractive, but blatantly Elliot's opposite. And gradually, Louisa, as time goes by and all these revelations unfold or unravel about her husband, she does find herself drawn to him, but is troubled by it because she doesn't know it's because she's vulnerable, that she needs companionship, or is it the start of something stronger, a deeper bond? And so as she tries to negotiate her feelings, it turns out that she has to depend on Leo, who is the only link to one of Elliot's deepest mysteries. So a lot of the book is her unraveling, solving the mystery that Elliot has left behind.
Interesting that you say Leo is sort of the opposite to Elliot. I think that can be quite a normal thing to when one relationship ends, if you like, the next person that you're with often has the qualities that the other person lacked.
Yeah, and may lack that the qualities the first person had.
Yeah.
But yes, you're quite right. I think not wanting to be sort of once bitten, twice shy.
Yes. So how long have you been working on this book?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It was finished, it came out last Thursday. It was finished last autumn. I mean, the whole process takes about approximately a year from when you start to write through the various edits you have to go through the copy edits and the proofs. So, you know, a year and a bit.
And what's
something
your,
like that?
What's your least favourite part about it? Is it the editing?
The first draft. I love the editing.
Oh, really?
I love it. Yeah, I find the first draft tough because you're faced with an empty page every single day until you've written the first draft, and sometimes it goes well, sometimes it goes badly, sometimes you're tearing your hair out, sometimes you look at it and think this is terrible, it'll never work. Mm. Sometimes you enjoy it. You sit down, you put your fingers on the keyboard, and you just have to keep going, despite sometimes it seeming awful. Because in the editing, once you get feedback from your editor, who can kind of say how she feels about the book and how she thinks a reader would feel about the book and where you maybe need to change the tone or add a character or delete a character or develop a character, or there may be plot holes you hadn't even seen. And once you've got something to work with, it's fun. So I really do enjoy the editing. It's my favourite part.
That's interesting. And you're okay about letting go of parts that maybe your editor suggests you do that you thought were good?
Totally. I mean, I've got an absolutely brilliant editor. She's publishing director of Viking at Penguin, and she's very experienced. And we have an excellent relationship. So I can say exactly what I feel, and we'll talk about it, and we'll explore how or what needs to be done. And I've never really, I can't think of anything where I've felt, oh no, I don't want to, you know, delete that. Or I mean, sometimes you think, oh God, I've got to delete quite a lot. But then you just get on and do it. I trust her, you see.
Yes, lovely. It's an important relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. If I didn't trust her and if we didn't have a good relationship, I can imagine it might get difficult. I mean, who knows? We might come to a book where we do have very different opinions about it, and I don't quite know what that would be like. It hasn't happened yet. So.
No. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, yeah. Yeah.
Well, if people want to get a copy of The Sapphire Widow, it's out now, and it's by Dinah Jeffries, who we've been chatting to today. Dinah, thank you very much for joining us.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. TRE, Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Oggy Boychef, who escaped from behind the Iron Curtain in 1986. Soon after, he joined the BBC in London, where he spent the next 25 years covering international conflicts. Latterly, he became John Simpson's producer and accompanied him on dangerous undercover assignments around the world. His memoir, Simpson and I, out in 2014, chronicles this time. But he's with us on the Book Show to talk about his debut novel, The Unbeliever. Welcome to the Book Show, Oggy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I know you were with us on the station a few years ago talking about the memoir, so it's great to have you back on Talk Radio Europe. For people who didn't hear the interview from a few years back, can you just remind people what it was like that time in your life?
Well, I must admit, it was dangerous, but at the same time, it was the most exciting time of my life. I know it's unusual to say that, but we went to places where normally people wouldn't go, from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe, from the Xinjiang province in China, where there is still a Muslim rebellion against the Chinese government, to Mexico, where the war on drugs is still going on, claiming thousands of lives. So it was a broad brush approach to world conflicts, and we were in every conflict possible around the globe. So in Iran, for example, we were arrested during the coverage of the 2009 anti-government street protests known as the Green Revolution. In Zimbabwe, we worked undercover because the BBC was banned by the Mugabe regime at the time. As I say, it was dangerous, but it was the most exciting time of my career.
Wow. I guess you had to have your wits about you, to say the least, at all times.
You know, when you do a job like this, if you think too much of the dangers, you're not going to do it. And I'm not saying we've been reckless, because before every trip, you do meticulous research and meticulous risk assessment. I know this risk assessment business sounds a bit trite, and all management companies are trying to introduce in all walks of life. But for us, risk assessment was an assessment of whether the story is worth the risk that you undertake, i.e. what you get is strong enough to warrant putting yourself and the lives of your crew in danger. For example, there are stories which we didn't undertake because the risk far outweighed the merits of the story, or what we could get in terms of a story. One example is the Congo. The Congolese conflict is the single biggest conflict in the world since the Second World War. It claimed the lives of 5 million people, but no one was able to get in because of the dangers posed by the warlords in the Katanga province. So we weren't able to get there, and that's one of the biggest regrets both Simpson and I had in our careers.
Well, I mean, you understand why you weren't able to go there, do you think?
We were, yes. We understood why, because we weren't able to get enough local support to be able to operate there. There are huge vested interests in the rich Katanga province, where all sorts of rare minerals are mined. There are all sorts of warlords. There is no single authority which controls the province. And this is why, this is one of the reasons why we couldn't get in. We even tried sending local fixers with cameras, and they couldn't get in either.
Gosh. Were you at any point, obviously not in this situation because you didn't get near it, but were you fearful for your life at times?
Oh, lots of times. We've been shot at, we've been bombed,
gosh,
both by friendly and enemy fire. One of the most glaring examples was at the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, when an American jet dropped a bomb by mistake on our convoy. We were traveling with Kurdish special forces from the north, edging towards Saddam Hussein's troops at the time. That was the beginning of April 2003, just before the war was won. And it was a genuine mistake by an American pilot who dropped a bomb on our convoy instead on Saddam's tanks. 47 people died, including our translator. Luckily, no one from our team was killed, but lots of us were injured.
Gosh, frightening stuff. And do you miss it, or are you happy that it's sort of over now and you're writing books?
My proverbial boots are firmly on my proverbial walls. I am not tempted by this. There is always a time in your career or in your life when you think, that's it for me, I'll let other people do it. It was very exciting, and I miss, when I watch television, for example, and I see a story from a war zone, I think, oh gosh, I would like to be there. But when I start thinking about the logistics and the risk assessment and all that, I say to myself, no, let other people do it now.
Yes, fair enough. So how has it been for you writing a novel for the first time?
Well, there is a background to this idea of a novel. As you said, I was brought up behind the Iron Curtain in Bulgaria. My father was interned in a place which we couldn't leave because of his anti-government activities. He was made to break stones in the local quarry for 10 hours a day. And I grew up in utmost poverty. There was no television. There was no entertainment. The cinema only opened on a Sunday morning. But we listened to the radio and we read books. So one morning, I was very young at primary school, I heard a voice on the radio, a calm, educated voice of a man who pleaded guilty of being an American spy. My imagination went into overdrive at the time. I was thinking, who is that man? What's it like to be an American spy? And I started to construct stories in my head about him. So the fictional character in my new novel, The Unbeliever, is based on that real-life character, who was a Bulgarian diplomat at the United Nations at the time, and sold secrets to the CIA. He's not a James Bond character. There are no car chases. There are no Bond villains. There are no shootouts. But there are mind games, and there are gadgets, and there are lots of women in his life. At the time of his trial, came out that the CIA had paid that man, the real-life spy, today's equivalent of $2 million,
wow,
which he spent entirely on his mistresses.
Interesting.
So he is the basis of my fictional character.
Okay. And was there a lot of information readily available about him?
There wasn't, and this is one of the reasons why I made the book into a novel. Originally, I wanted to do a non-fiction story about this real-life spy, but when I delved into the archives in Bulgaria, there was hardly anything available. I don't know the reasons for that. The Americans never acknowledged him as one of their assets, so they only issued a very short statement to that effect. So I started to construct, again, like I did in my childhood days, a story around him. What made him betray? He was an ardent communist at the time. What made him betray the cause of communism and start selling state secrets to the CIA?
It's an interesting question, isn't it? And kind of sad that there isn't much of a record about him.
I suspect that most of the record has been erased, probably before and soon after the collapse of communism. One of the strands of the book is the political implications and the involvement of the ruling elite, the ruling communist elite, in supplying information to the former fascist police in Bulgaria, because Bulgaria was a German ally during the Second World War. It was ruled by a fascist government. And one of the allegations widely available at the moment is that some of the people who became the ruling elite in Bulgaria and the communists were actually traitors before and during the war.
So when we're reading the book, are you expecting people to not like this man?
I've been told that people relate to him once you get to know him. He's not a likable character. That is true. He's not a likable character. He treated his lovers sometimes with contempt. He sold secrets for money. He betrayed his original communist ideas. But at the same time, he was very clever. He was very clever. He realized that the new regime that was being built in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union after the Second World War was not going to survive. It was not only economically bankrupt, but morally bankrupt. So, to that effect, people can sympathize with him.
Absolutely. So, is this going to be the first of many novels, do you think?
Well, I have two manuscripts in my desk at the moment. I'm working on a fictional book about the hunt for Gaddafi's gold, which is one thing that has been preoccupying my imagination since John Simpson and I worked in Libya during the fall of the Gaddafi regime. Yes, hold your breath.
Oh, fantastic. I'm guessing all your work with the BBC and John Simpson must have, you've got a lot of great stories and must be have a lot of raw material, I guess, to put novels together.
There is a lot of raw material, but I didn't realize how difficult it is to write a novel compared with a memoir or non-fiction book where you're actually guided by the events in history, whereas in a novel you have to construct a story, a believable story, and work around that.
So it's much harder writing novels, you think?
It's much harder. For me, it's much harder to write a novel than a non-fiction book.
Interesting. Well, we look forward to many more from you, Oggy. In the meantime, if people want to get a copy of your first novel, it's called The Unbeliever, and it's by Oggy Bochev, who we've been chatting to today. Oggy, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck.
Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is C.D. Rose. He's the author of the satirical book, The Biographical Dictionary of Literary Failure, and is an award-winning short story writer. He currently teaches at the University of Birmingham, and he's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel, Who's Who When Everyone Is Someone Else. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great to have you with us. And before we talk about the new book, can you just tell us a little bit about the book I mentioned? Because I love the title, The Biographical Dictionary of Literary Failure.
The Biographical Dictionary of Literary Failure has a long and complex story, but to keep it as simple as I can, that it is the stories of 52 writers, brief biographies of 52 writers who achieved a certain level of failure. That is, they have all been lost, forgotten, or vanished for some reason. Sometimes it's their own fault. Sometimes it's just the brutal machinations of history have conspired against them. So, yeah, it's 52 very short stories about writers.
And have you picked them because you don't think they should have failed in such a way?
They're a whole mix. There are 52 of them. Some of them probably did deserve their own ignominious ending, but a lot of them didn't. I think I'm not being nasty about them. One or two I might have poked fun at, but a lot of them, I'm genuinely, the idea is to save them from the dustbin of history, and in some ways to remember them in any way that we can. So a lot of them, no, didn't deserve their fate, no.
So do you expect that a lot of people reading the book won't have heard of many of the authors?
They're pretty obscure. They're pretty obscure.
How did you find them?
That's a very good question. There are two stories to this. I mean, and there is the one story that I say, well, I found them after years and years of research, of looking in abandoned libraries and secondhand bookshops and trash piles, and talking to elderly scholars and people who may have remembered or met these obscure writers at one point, which is a lovely story that I love. The other story is that I just made them all up.
All of them?
Yeah.
Is that common knowledge?
It's kind of weird. Some people who've read the book are very genuinely, oh, I'm curious, and how can I find more about these writers? And other people kind of twig it straight away. But I like the idea there's this balance. Is this true? Is this not true? Is this true? A lot of people have genuinely been kind of questioning. And there was one very earnest review of the book which said, it's a very interesting book because some of the writers are fictional and some of the writers are real. I thought,
you've done it.
So
tell us about this new book then, Who's Who When Everyone Is Someone Else. Another great title.
This is kind of the follow-up to the Biographical Dictionary of Literary Failure. The idea is that the person who put together the Biographical Dictionary of Literary Failure, the editor, based on the modest success of that book, gets invited to a university in an unnamed city somewhere in Eastern Europe. He gets invited to give a course of lectures about his subjects, only this time the lectures are not about writers but about books. He's asked to give a course of lectures, 10 lectures on great lost, forgotten, or vanished books. So what the book is, it actually contains these lectures that the narrator gives, and it's interspersed with his various adventures and misadventures as he spends 3 months in this city.
And what is this lecturer like? Do we like him as a character?
Well, I hope so. he tries his best. Yes, he's a bit bookish and a bit eccentric in some ways, but he tries his best. He just gets a bit baffled, a bit confused by the world around him sometimes. And doesn't always understand what's going on.
Yeah, and I'm assuming these forgotten books aren't actual books again.
Well, they are certainly very, very obscure books, and it might be very difficult to track them down.
What's your favourite of these books?
Sorry?
What's your favourite of these books?
Blimey, that's a good question, really. I mean, the 10 books that he gives lectures about are all, deliberately, they're all quite different. So one's a kind of a ghost horror story, one's a crime novel, one's a very passionate romantic novel, one is a very experimental novel. Which one is my favourite? I don't... I'm trying to think now. I'm very fond of them all, really. There is one called The Mystery of the Phantom Train, which I kind of like. It's a ghost story set somewhere in northern England or northeastern England about as the title says, about a ghostly train and a man who thinks he sees this train and then becomes obsessed in trying to track this train down, even though it may not exist at all, which I'm rather fond of.
And the idea about books being forgotten about as a general rule, why is it that obviously there are great authors and books that people are reading at school and still read classic literature from hundreds of years ago, if you like. Is it possible to know what successful books in the last 20, 50 years or so will be remembered in another 20 to 50 years' time, do you think?
Well, that's a very good question, and that is one of the things I want to address, is that how these things shift and change. And I think it's probably almost impossible to say what things that are very popular now will still be read in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, because these things change hugely. You know, I mean, if we think about like the Victorian era, for example, you know, a great period of world literature and of English literature, and obviously the names come to us. Charles Dickens, you know, the most famous, but the most best-selling writers of that era were probably, what's his name? Henry Bulwer Lytton, outsold Dickens 3-1.
Really?
These days, try and find any of his, I'm not even sure any of his books are in print. He's almost totally forgotten, complete footnote to history. We never really know. And even if you look back at English literature, even in the 1950s and 60s, people were reading, you know, the most famous novelists were people like C.P. Snow or Anthony Pohl, who these days, again, almost entirely forgotten. And that's only in the last 40, 50 years that shift has happened. So it's very difficult to know. Fortune is a fickle thing.
Yes, I suppose the fact that something's sold really well doesn't necessarily guarantee that it will be remembered in many years' time. I mean, obviously, if you look at the Harry Potter books, I'm assuming, who knows, as you say, we can't predict, but I'm assuming they will be remembered and talked about for many years, whereas something like 50 Shades of Grey, let's say, no disrespect to the author or the stories, but they might not, whereas they've also sold extremely well.
I agree with you entirely. Sales figures are great for the writers concerned, because at least you get to live them, but they're no guarantee whatsoever of posterity.
Fascinating. So how do you kind of put your books together? Do you know exactly where you're going with the story before you start writing?
With Who's Who, it was, I had an idea. I had the idea for it. So I had the 10 lectures. In fact, I had more than 10. I had to think about 12, 13, 14, 15, and I had to just choose the 10. And they were already... I wrote them first. They were already written. I knew that. And then I just had to kind of string the story around those lectures. And so now I had an idea of the character and the setting. And then it was simply opening the document and seeing what happened with it, where it went. The story invented itself as it happened, really. That bit wasn't carefully planned. I had an idea of the overall structure, but not of the details. No.
And how would you describe the book? I know publishers like to sort of label books and give you a genre and things. And when I was researching the book today, I found some websites saying that it's satire, others saying it's a mystery. And how would you describe it?
The question I find most difficult to answer, and I relinquish, I hope this doesn't sound rude or like I'm being difficult, but I relinquish any responsibility for categorizing the book or putting it in a genre. That is a job for readers and critics and other people. I just write the stuff, you decide what it is.
Fair enough. And do you think you'll always write this kind of book?
Well, the character, the editor, has definitely got one more adventure coming. There will be a third book in this sequence. After that, I hope we can leave him in peace, and I'd like to write other things.
Do you know what other things you'd like to write?
Well, I mostly write short fiction. I love short stories. And indeed, I mean, what one of these things, these books are in a way, are collections of short stories in a certain light. I'd like to write more short stories. I'm a big fan and a big supporter of short stories.
Yeah, I always find it strange why short stories aren't better known, I suppose. You know, they don't seem to be up there with the full-length novels a lot of the time. Why is that?
That is a very good question. I think there are lots of reasons. I think one of them is commercial. I think publishers have trouble selling short stories for various reasons. I think another one is kind of a misunderstanding of what short stories are and what short stories do. Because of the preponderance of the novel over the last 100 years, I think people expect short stories to be like a miniature novel, and so they're often disappointed when they're not, whereas actually what the short story is should be thought of as much closer to being like a poem. A short story is about capturing a moment, an instant in time, and a thought, and it can have a narrative within that, but it's a different experience, and we need to expect a different experience when we read a short story rather than expecting it to deliver everything a novel does in 30 minutes.
You'd think that because we're all so busy, more people would be too busy to read a novel and a short story would be perfect.
Well, again, that's often said, but actually I think that's slightly misleading, because you can get the entire experience in a short period of time, but short story requires much more concentration, again as if it were a poem. A good short story is very demanding on the attention, even though it might only demand 15-20 minutes of your attention. It will demand your full attention for those 15-20 minutes, and as we know in this modern world, having full attention for half an hour is quite a difficult thing to find. We get so distracted so easily.
And what about the construction of a story? When you write a short story or you write a novel, is the process very different?
For me it is. I'm sure for every writer it's different, but for me short stories for me are very much centered on a particular moment. So it's, you've got a instance of time, and that's what I'm looking at, and then you can ripple out from that this particular moment, whereas in a novel it's about time. There's just much more of a time span to cover. You're not thinking about one particular moment, so it's kind of almost different end of the telescope, if you can imagine it that way.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, Who's Who When Everyone Is Someone Else, it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. And it's by C.D. Rose, who we've been chatting to today. Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Hannah. It's been a pleasure.
Talk Radio. TRE. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Dee McDonald, who flew as a stewardess on long-haul routes for 8 years. She was also a receptionist at Thames Television Studios and spent 10 years dishing out B&Bs in Cornwall. But she's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel. It's called The Runaway Wife. It's a laugh-out-loud, feel-good novel about second chances. Welcome to the book show, Dee.
Thank you, Hannah.
Pleasure. It's great to have you with us. And congratulations, your first book.
Yes, it's taken me long enough, but yes, I've cracked it.
I understand you've been wanting to write for a while, have you? Has it been a sort of lifelong dream in a way?
Well, I started off as a child enjoying writing and doing well at essays in school and all that kind of thing. But then, you know, life got in the way and lots of things happened. And it wasn't really until after retirement that I took it up again and joined a creative writing class, had a couple of things published, a short story and a poem, and thought, well, can't be too bad. So thought I'd try writing a novel.
And how did you find it?
Well, I found it great. I enjoyed it. It's such an escape. You go into another world for a few hours while you're working on it, and I love that.
And was it as easy as you thought? Or did you find it hard, or what was the journey like?
I didn't find it hard. Perhaps I should have done, because I had lots of editing to do afterwards. But no, I didn't find it hard. I found it enjoyable.
Oh, that's good. So do you think this will be the first of many?
Well, I don't know. The first one, it was quite some time ago. I wrote a book based on my flying experience. It was fiction, but based on my flying experience. But nobody was really very interested in it, so it's still reclining in a drawer upstairs in the bedroom somewhere. And so The Runaway Wife is really my second book, if you want to. And a third one called The Getaway Girls will come out in August.
Okay, fantastic. So have you already finished that?
Yes, I have, but there's quite a lot of editing to do.
Yeah. So tell us about The Runaway Wife then. Who is this runaway wife?
Well, like most women, you know, there's been times when I felt a bit put upon, taken for granted, unappreciated, blah, blah. And I felt like marching out and slamming the door and leaving them all to it. But also, like most women, I've got a safety valve that clicks in and stops me from doing that. And what would I have done? Where would I have gone? I'd probably have got to the end of the road and thought it wasn't such a good idea after all. So I decided to let my protagonist, 66-year-old Connie McCall, wife, mother and grandmother, let her venture forth and find out on my behalf. And so she takes off in her little green car all the way from the south of England to the north of Scotland and back again. And the people she meets and the experiences she has all help her to decide what she's going to do with the rest of her life. And having made that decision, she finally comes home, and there's a little twist at the end, but I've no intention of revealing that, obviously.
No, definitely. So tell us about some of the interesting people she meets along the way.
Well, she meets a young hitchhiker who appears a couple of times in the book. She meets a woman who she sits at a table with in a cafe in near Manchester, who is not at all like her, but who she becomes very friendly with because they find they've got something in common. She meets all kinds of people. She meets an old lady in Newcastle who used to be a dancer and has a very interesting history. She meets her old next-door neighbours that were in Edinburgh, and she meets, best of all, she meets a man. And he kind of shows her what she's been missing. Shall we put it that way?
Yes, okay. I'm with you, I think. So the people that she meets, do they kind of influence her end result, if you like, her decision to go back home?
Very much so, very much so. Because she realises that life had been very dull for her, and it's opened up all kinds of new ideas, new avenues. And she goes back with a totally different take on life.
Mm. Do you think it's something that a lot of people could benefit from, just having a little holiday, if you like, as opposed to running away, maybe?
Yes, I quite agree. I quite agree. I mean, I'm really aiming my book at mainly at older ladies by giving them a kind of a 66-year-old believable heroine who finally has the courage, you know, to go out and make some changes. And while I'm not advocating that older ladies should walk out and leave their families, I am suggesting that, you know, it's never too late to make a few changes, however small. A new hairdo, a new hobby, anything, you know?
Mm. Yes, it's true, isn't it? It must be very easy to kind of just get stuck into the same old routine and not have any excitement wherever it comes
from. Exactly. Mm. So, you know, I think you have to make the changes yourself in your own life if you need to.
Yeah. So has it been fun living through Connie? Have you learned anything from Connie?
Yes. I'm just trying to think what exactly I have learned. I've learned not to take people at face value, because Connie learned that. And as the book will reveal, your first impressions of people are not always accurate. So I've learned that, and I've learned to enjoy life every moment, you know?
Mm. It's important. A great lesson for people to learn, I think.
I think so.
Do you think people reading the book will really get behind Connie?
I think they will. I think so, because I think they'll identify with her. I'm not saying that everybody's as put upon as Connie is, but nevertheless, there's a little bit of Connie in everyone, and I think certainly women, will identify with it, without a doubt.
So have you been quite good with the writing? I know you mentioned, you know, doing a few hours of writing every day. Were you writing the same time each day?
No, I wasn't. But I do wake up very early, and quite honestly, I was getting my best writing done quite often between about 5 in the morning and 7 or 8 in the morning, and then maybe an hour in the afternoon. So it's been very erratic, but nevertheless, it's got there.
That's impressive, getting up so early to write. So you're not tired when you wake up at that time?
No, I'm just one of these insomniacs, you know.
Well, whatever works.
Exactly.
I have to ask you about your time. I mentioned in the introduction being a receptionist at Thames Television Studios. That must have been fascinating.
That was fun. That was fun, because it was in the days of people like Morecambe and Wise and Benny Hill and Tommy Cooper, etc., etc. And apart from anything else, I had to allocate dressing rooms, and that was quite an eye-opener. There was an awful lot of king-size egos around, and everybody wants the same dressing room, and oh, dear me. Yeah, but it was fun. Nevertheless, it was fun.
Must have been great to meet all those people looking back.
Yeah, yes. Well, you know, I mean, you only met them briefly as far as telling them where their dressing room was and sometimes arguing about the size of it or whatever. But, yes, it was good.
And how about having a B&B in Cornwall?
Yeah, we came down here 26 years ago, and we bought this old cottage, and I only did a couple of rooms. It wasn't a huge B&B, but I was very, very busy, because it was in an idyllic situation on the canal in Bude, and it had a huge garden, lovely sort of canal frontage, and it was a couple of hundred years old, so it did appeal to people, and I think I did them quite well. I had so many repeat bookings each year, and in fact we still have people who stayed with us then coming to see us now. So
lovely. Well, it's been great to have you with us on the book show. Best of luck with The Runaway Wife, and we look forward
to
the next book coming out in the summer. Dee McDonald, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.